Chapter 5, Life Interrupted. I enrolled at Cal the week before classes formally started, and we began football practice for the freshman team at that time. Even though I was really looking forward to it and excited about it, they had already given us big playbooks, and I could tell the whole thing was going to be more like a job and a business. In high school, you had to learn plays and you had to practice, but it wasn't all so serious. There was a camaraderie about it, and there was a particular social experience that went along with it in a school like Berkeley High at that time. It was also just fun. But I could already tell this was going to be a much different atmosphere. Nevertheless, both because I loved football, and because it was sort of a thing I'd always dreamed of doing, I still wanted to play football for Cal. Uh-oh, that's not good. Hospitalized. But during that week, I started feeling sick. I would be throwing up a lot. I noticed that while I hadn't changed my diet or anything, I was gaining weight really quickly. Even though a lot of different things indicated that something was wrong, I thought that maybe I just had a little bit of the flu. But this persisted for that whole week, and I kept vomiting all the time. It's one thing if you do that a couple of times in one day, or for a couple of days. But this went on all week. Every time I would do anything and exert myself, I'd feel all right for a little while, and then I'd feel terrible. Or I'd be hungry and eat food, but as soon as I ate, I felt terrible. I was staying that semester with my parents, and finally I talked to them and said, "I really think I better go to the student clinic and see what's wrong, whether I have a bad case of the flu or whatever." So my dad drove me down to the student clinic, and I still remember the last words he said as I got out of the car and headed for the clinic. "Well, don't let them keep you." So I went into the clinic and I described my symptoms, and they gave me a urine test and some blood tests. Pretty soon they came back and said, "We have to admit you to the hospital. You've got kidney casts in your urine, and you've got albumin, protein, in your urine. And that means there's something wrong with your kidney function." So I was put in a room, and as I mentioned, I had been inexplicably gaining weight. So they said, "Don't give him anything to eat, but let him drink as much water as he wants." They wanted to see what would happen. And between that afternoon and evening, I gained 5 pounds because my kidneys were basically shutting down and I was retaining all the water that I was drinking. At this point, my parents called a friend of theirs who was a doctor and asked him to go check and see what was happening. When they told him what the urine test had showed, he said, "Uh-oh, that's not good," and explained to them that it could mean there was a serious problem with my kidneys. I was in this room with 3 other people, and all of them were having visitors. They were all laughing and joking, and this doctor friend of my parents came in, and he didn't have the best style. He just yelled at everybody in the room, "Be quiet, settle down, don't you realize that this patient here," pointing at me, "is very sick?" And that was the first time that I knew that I was very sick. I knew from what they said about the test that something wasn't right, and the fact that I was gaining this weight meant something. But this was news to me, in a very bad way. "This patient is very sick." Right after that, they moved me into a room by myself. This all happened very quickly. The next day, the head of the medical staff at the student clinic, who became my doctor, his name was Mort Meyer, and he was a really great guy, came in and took over my case, because he recognized it was very serious, and he told me frankly that I was very sick. And for a couple of months I was in the hospital in a bad way because my kidneys just completely shut down. But it's kind of funny. They were telling me I was very sick, and obviously the way they were saying it meant they were serious. You could follow that logically and know that you might die. But for whatever reason, I didn't really think about dying. I just knew I was very sick, and the question was how to get well. That was what was on my mind. My parents, I know, got the point that I was very sick, and the implications of that. After all, there were no transplants at that time. They could put you on dialysis, where they basically take your blood out and filter it and put it back into your body, because your kidneys are supposed to do that, but they're not functioning. And they almost did that with me. But you couldn't stay on dialysis indefinitely, and dialysis then wasn't even as good as it is now. I know that my parents understood right away the seriousness of the situation. Although my father was very affectionate and wasn't one of those fathers who wouldn't show emotions, He didn't cry a lot in front of other people. And I was told by my mother and my younger sister later on that he went into a closet and just wept because he understood what this meant. To save my life, I became kind of like a test tube. They would come in every morning and take a bunch of blood tests to see what the chemicals in my blood were. Since my kidneys weren't functioning, I wasn't allowed to eat anything for about a month. I could drink about 500 milliliters of water and an additional amount of water equal to whatever I was able to urinate for the day, which was often very, very little, because it's your kidneys that release the urine. So all this uremic poisoning was backing up in my body because I couldn't urinate. The doctor used to come in, look at my eyes, and see that I had uremic poisoning in my eyes. They would come in the morning and take these tests, and if my potassium were too low, they would give me potassium during the day in pills, and if my potassium were too high, they would give me something to counterbalance that. So I felt as if I were a test tube, and they were chemically adjusting what was going on in my body to keep me alive, especially during the acute phase, which lasted more than a month. That's why I couldn't eat anything, because they didn't want anything to complicate things further. Every time you eat, it affects the chemical balance of everything in your body. Even when I wasn't eating, I used to vomit 3 or 4 times a day. Vomiting became a function like blowing your nose. It was unpleasant, but I got so used to it that when people would visit me and I got nauseous, I'd say, "Could you excuse me for a second? I have to vomit." Despite that, one thing that was hard was that I'd get very hungry every day. There was a guy across the hall from me who had hepatitis. And because that weakens the body, they had him on a 5,000 calorie a day diet. He would describe to me how he had 2 or 3 milkshakes a day, and I would get really jealous. You know, in the hospital, one of the things people look forward to, if they're not too sick, is mealtime. It breaks up the monotony, and you get something to eat. I used to lie there and listen to the dishes clinking on the trays, but I could never eat. I was hungry, but if I'd eaten, I would have felt even worse. I can still remember when finally they let me have something to eat. It was a peach. I remember how grateful I was and how I profusely thanked the orderly in the hospital who went out and got that peach and gave it to me with some fanfare. Of course, there were a lot of ways in which this whole thing was very difficult. The treatment wasn't as bad as the sickness, but sometimes you kind of wondered, because they'd have to get potassium in me by one means or another. So one time they gave me these great big horse capsules that were full of potassium, and I'd have to take something like 15 of them at a time. I'd take so many, and then I'd throw up, so then I'd have to take them again. Or they'd give me this potassium in liquid form. One day, after I'd passed the most acute stage of this, they brought in this glass of orange juice, and they said, "Here's some orange juice with just a little bit of medicine in it." I said, "Okay," and I started drinking. I took one swig, and I can't even describe the taste. It just made my body shiver. It was such an awful taste. I went, "Yuck, what is that?" "That's potassium, but there's only a teaspoon in there." I said, "I don't care. Please, the next time you bring me potassium, bring me the potassium separately and then give me the orange juice on the side. I'll take the potassium down, and then I'll have the orange juice to wash away the taste." Since then, I've used this as a metaphor sometimes, the one teaspoon of potassium that ruins a whole glass of orange juice. But that was not as bad as what I had to go through earlier, when I couldn't orally take in the potassium because I'd throw it up. Then they decided that the only way they could keep it in me was to give it to me by enema. So I'd have to have an 8-hour drip of potassium coming in by that means. It didn't hurt, but there was a pressure buildup, the way it is with IV drips. If a nurse doesn't come around to check it every so often, then the drip will start going a little faster. The nurses can get very busy and preoccupied with something else, and it starts going faster and faster. And the more it goes, the more pressure builds up. One time I was something like 7 hours and 45 minutes into the 8-hour potassium enema. The pressure is building more and more, and I'm furiously pushing on the buzzer to get the nurses to come and turn it down. But before they could get there, everything just came back out, and I had to start it all over again. These are the kind of things you had to put up with in order to overcome this disease, especially in its acute phase. All this was very difficult psychologically as well as physically. For example, one of the ways that my parents knew I was really sick and even I recognized it, was one Saturday they were visiting me, and there was a Cal football game on the radio. And my dad said to me, "Do you want me to put the football game on?" I was lying in bed, and I could barely work up the energy to answer, "No, I'm too tired. I don't feel up to listening to it." And they knew that if I were too sick to even feel up to listening to a football game, then it was very serious. There was also a time when a doctor other than Dr. Meyer was on rounds at the hospital, and he came in to check on me. He asked, "How are you feeling?" I said, "Not very good." So we started talking, and then I told him, "Here's what bothers me. Sometimes when I stand up, like to go to the bathroom or something, if I feel up to that, pretty soon I feel weak and bad. But then if that's the case, I can sit down. And then when I'm sitting down and I feel really bad and really weak, I can lie down. But what about the times when I'm lying down and I feel really weak and really bad? What do I do then?" And the doctor looked at me and said, "Just try to rest." It only dawned on me later that clearly I was very close to dying. That was really what my question reflected. And the doctor, of course, knew it. But what could he say? I never had the attitude that I'm dying, I'm just going to let go. I had the attitude, I'm sick, I'm going to get over this. I would always ask the doctor, "When am I going to be well? When am I going to be over this?" Because I was young, and even though this hit me completely out of the blue and really knocked me down, I felt like, I'm going to overcome this. I'm going to conquer this. I'm going to get back on my feet. I'm going to do what I did before. But of course, it is very difficult when you feel the way a lot of youth do, invulnerable and optimistic and enthusiastic and very confident about life. And all of a sudden, everything's knocked out from underneath you. You're just barely hanging on to life, and you feel completely vulnerable in a way you never did before. Friends. My friends were a big part of giving me the support and strength to keep going, as well as my father, my mother, and my sisters. My friends would take time away from other things to be with me. When you're 18 years old, 19 years old, you want to be doing a lot of things, but they would spend hours with me when they were allowed to visit in the hospital. They would come and do all kinds of things to try to keep my spirits up and keep me in the orientation of fighting this, rather than giving in. I was in the hospital for a couple of months in this sort of acute phase. Then they let me go home for Thanksgiving. After that, I went back into the hospital to get a biopsy of my kidneys. The biopsy was actually somewhat encouraging because it showed that there was damage to the tubes of my kidneys, but not to what's called the glomeruli, which are the actual filtering units. So that meant there was a reasonable chance that I would recover, whereas if I'd had serious damage to the filtering units, the glomeruli in the kidneys, I would have had a much worse prognosis. They decided they'd start me on these cortisone steroid treatments. They put me back in the hospital to start these treatments because I was very weak and also because they wanted to monitor me. Cortisone is a very, very powerful drug, and they were giving me very high dosages to begin with. So I went back into the hospital for several weeks. The cortisone had all kinds of physical side effects. It can also have very serious psychological side effects, which fortunately I never had. But physically, you get what is called Cushing syndrome, where all the fat in your body gets mobilized into your trunk. Your neck gets really thick, your face swells out, while your arms and your legs become very thin and your muscles tend to get broken down. And I couldn't do any exercise to counter that. So this had a very distorting effect on the way I looked. You look very swollen and sort of disfigured, especially when you're taking high dosages of cortisone. Within a month or so, I began to experience those kinds of symptoms. I responded well to the treatments on one level, and I was actually in relatively good spirits. I remember there was this guy who was a cook in the hospital where I was then. He used to be on the basketball team at Berkeley High. His name was LaVon Cookie Patton. He had been a year or two ahead of me in high school, and when he found out I was in the hospital during his off hours or downtime, he'd come up and visit with me for a while. That meant a lot to me. It was good for my spirits. I didn't realize then that I still had a long-term battle ahead. I was hoping that I would get this steroid treatment, this cortisone, and I'd get well in a few months, then I'd be back to what I was before. But actually, it was 3 years before that happened. And a lot went on during that time. I got sick right at the beginning of September in 1961, and I wasn't able to go back to school, even on a limited basis, until the next fall. So there was a whole year when I was basically recuperating. And at the beginning of that, after I got out of the hospital and was just getting going with the cortisone treatments, I had to spend a lot of time at home because I was very weak and I was only really beginning to overcome the acute phase. Rethinking. During those years, while it would have been an exaggeration to say that I literally didn't recognize myself when I looked in the mirror, in all but the most literal sense, that was true. I just looked completely different to myself, really disfigured. I was altered very significantly in my physical appearance, and not in a good way. And I was also very sickly. I grew up in this society and came of age in the 50s, with all the conventional and superficial ways in which people are conditioned to think about relations between boys and girls, men and women. And I obviously was conditioned myself by all that. For example, I mentioned that among my good friends in high school were girls who were intellectuals and whom I respected for their minds and their thinking. On the other hand, while I didn't go for the classical separation, where there are some girls who are smart and they're friends, and there are other ones who are pretty or sexy or whatever, and they're the ones you are interested in romantically, a girl did have to be good-looking, in the conventional sense, for me to get romantically interested. But when everything's knocked out from underneath you, and your whole life changes, and even your looks change in this way, your outlook begins to change too. It wasn't as if there were an epiphany, and my whole viewpoint changed completely all at once. But it did start me thinking in a different way and more deeply about what's really important in people, and in particular women, both as friends and even as people in whom you might be romantically interested. But this was only the beginning and part of a longer-term process through which I underwent some real changes. It wasn't an overnight dramatic thing where I woke up one morning, looked at myself in the mirror and said, "Well, look what happened to you, so why bother to think any more about how people look?" That would be an exaggeration and a silly distortion. But it did cause me to start thinking more deeply about what really matters in people. What are the important qualities in people? Also, my friends were coming to visit me when I was able to go home from the hospital, but couldn't get out of the house for a while. My friends would spend their weekends with me, and this meant a tremendous amount to me. They could have been, and probably on one level, would have liked to be, out doing a whole bunch of other things. But they cared about me, and it was important to them to be with me and give me support. And this kind of thing also makes you think differently and more deeply about things, or at least begin to. I wouldn't necessarily have described myself as popular in high school. I was controversial. I was popular with some people and very unpopular with other people, including people who were popular in the classical and conventional sense. But I did think of myself as a guy who's got something going for him, and I more or less expected people to like me. As for those who didn't like me, fuck 'em. It was for good reason they didn't like me. It was because I was doing things that I believed in, and things that I wanted to do that are important and right. So if they don't like me for that reason, to hell with them. There are other people who will like me. That was all part of the whole brimming with confidence thing, which also partly comes from the background that I came out of, where the world seems like it's open to you. Then all of a sudden you were knocked down with this serious illness and all its side effects, and you don't have everything going for you. Of course, I still had a lot of people and resources to support me. My parents still had money for my health, and my mother spent a couple of years basically revolving her life around helping me recuperate, down to the level of paying very minute attention to my diet, which was very restricted. For example, I could only have very, very limited amounts of sodium every day. I used to write up menus, going through books calibrating the milligrams of sodium in different things. Then my mom would find the right foods and prepare the meals that fit that diet. She had to weigh everything. She had to shop at special stores, at a time when they didn't have the whole broad array of health food stores and different kinds of health foods that they have now. So this took up a big part of her life for a couple of years, besides giving me other kinds of practical and emotional support. At a time when I was beginning to go out on my own, All of a sudden, I was forced not only to live at home for a couple of years, but to be very dependent on my family. My older sister, Marjorie, was out of the house at that point. My younger sister, Mary Lou, was in high school. She was very supportive, but she also had her own life. And while my parents also cared about her and her life and paid attention to that, they frankly devoted a lot of time to my needs. And my mother in particular did this on almost an hour-by-hour basis, especially in the early stages, to help me survive and recover. Of course, I had tremendous appreciation and gratitude for my mom and for everything that she was doing for me. I was always very fond of my mom, but this made it much deeper. And no birds sing. There was also a more intangible part of this whole experience that was extremely difficult emotionally. Taking all this medicine all the time, and the side effects it had, including the physical disfigurement, and not being able to go out and do the things that I loved, all took a heavy toll. Certain things became very important to me. For instance, my family had a recording of Harry Belafonte, whom I really liked, and I used to play that record over and over again, because somehow it lifted my spirits and made me feel better. Also, by this time I had started to get really interested in poetry. This started during my last years in high school. I really got into the English Romantic poets, Keats in particular. While I was recuperating at home, I used to read Keats, and sometimes late at night I would stay up and constantly play this recording of this English actor, Ralph Richardson, reading some of Keats' poems, because it seemed to suit my mood and my orientation at the time. I liked the beginning of the Keats poem, Endymion, which has that famous line about how a thing of beauty is a joy forever. I like the classical Keats ode poems, especially Ode to a Nightingale and Ode on a Grecian Urn, which ended with, "Beauty is truth, truth beauty. That is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know." It's funny, not too long ago I was watching a movie where they quoted a line from a Keats poem without attributing it. There was a scene by some water, and one of the characters in the movie says, "The sedge is withered from the lake." And as I was watching this, I said to myself the next line of the poem, "And no birds sing." I still remember lines from Keats' poems that are very evocative and seem to be especially speaking to me at that time. But with all the pain and difficulties, I still had this attitude that I'm going to get my health back. I'm going to get back everything that's been taken away. I'm going to get back to what I was and where I was. I'm going to resume my life. But also, society was changing at this time in dramatic ways. And because of the influence of these larger things, which I was still very passionately interested in, I just didn't think very much about giving up. Of course, there would be moments of despair when I'd really feel down. But I'd rebound from that, because I still felt that I was going to overcome this. As soon as I was able, I tried to throw myself into things that could give my life some meaning within the severe limitations that it had. At the beginning, the doctors had been worried that any kind of exposure to infection could just kill me. But within a few months, they said, "Well, now you're past that phase, even though you still have to be careful." And as soon as I was able, I wanted to get back out. I wanted to go and watch sports. I wanted to go to musical concerts. I wanted to go to poetry readings. I wanted to go listen to jazz. And I wanted to follow what was going on in the world. At the same time, because of the way I felt about being acutely physically disfigured, I was very reluctant to go out and even see anybody that I knew. One thing that my friends and I were later able to laugh about, but at the time was very painful for me, was that my friends would come over and visit me and say, "Look, you know you got to get out of the house. You got to get out and do things. You can't just sit here all day. The doctors say you can do it now. Let's go. Let's go do a few things." And I would be tempted, but I'd answer, "Nah, I don't want to. I'm not ready to do it." It wasn't because I didn't feel physically up to it, although I would get tired very quickly, but because I didn't want to face people that I'd known before looking the way I look now. My friends worked on me for literally 2 or 3 weeks. "Come on, let's go out. We'll go down to the library. You can read a few books down there, and we'll just hang out." They wore me down. I finally gave in. So a couple of friends drove me down to the library to meet this other friend of mine, Art. Art hadn't seen me since I'd gotten sick, but these other friends of mine had been visiting me all the time, so they knew what the deal was and what I looked like. They helped me into the library, and there I was in the entryway to the library, and they said, "Okay, we're going to go get Art." Now, Art wasn't always known for having the most tact anyway, but they brought him out to where I was, and he looked around, not recognizing me. So they pointed to me, "That's him, there." Art stared at me for a second, and then he exclaimed, "God, what happened to you?" I just turned around and walked out of the library, went back to the car, and refused to go out of the house again for the better part of a month. But finally I got over that, because there were things happening in the world. There were things I cared about, and there were things I wanted to do. I started doing things that I could do. I started going into basketball games. I went to some of the Cal games, but actually I was more interested in high school sports, and I mainly went to Berkeley High and other high school games. Right before I got sick, when I had just come back from Yosemite, a good friend of mine from high school, Jeff, had died from tetanus. His family was one of many black families that had recently come up from the South, and he didn't have any tetanus shots. He had been working around some construction. They were tearing down some things, and there were all these boards with nails. It was this horrible thing where after he stepped on a nail, he waited a couple of days to go to the hospital, and by the time he did go, it was too late. So this had a big effect on me too. Soon after I had gotten sick, my old high school had a football game, and they dedicated the game to Jeff and to me. So a lot of my friends thought I was dead. I remember a guy who was a year behind me in school, Melvin, who was very tight with Jeff but was also a friend of mine, said to me some months later, "You know, they told me that Jeff died. Then they told me that you died too," and I remember his words to this day, and I just looked at the ground. A little later, Melvin had a breakdown and became very mentally ill. So these are the kinds of heavy things that were going on. Anyway, I finally started getting out, and besides sports events, I would go to some of the clubs that I could go to that would admit people under 21. Then I started looking for things to do that I thought would be useful, that would mean something. I started tutoring people at my old high school, particularly some of the guys who were into athletics, but also other students, because that was something that I could do, and it made me feel as if I were doing something worthwhile. Now give me my milkshake. I referred earlier to this guy who was in my sister's class in high school named Jerry Williams, who was this really great sprinter with a beautiful style of running. He had a lively personality and his own approach to how he ran. When I went back to do tutoring at my old high school, sometimes I'd help officiate at track meets and I'd see him run, and I still vividly remember different things that gave a sense of his style. One time there was a meet at Castlemont in East Oakland, and I went out there to see the meet in general, and specifically to see Jerry run, because it was always a great thing to see. Castlemont had these two sprinters who were supposed to be pretty good, but Jerry won the 100, and then it came to the 220. At that time, races were measured in yards, not meters. They came off the curve, and Jerry was ahead by a few yards, and he lengthened his lead, so he was ahead by more than 5 yards. He got down to about 20 yards from the finish line, and you could see him just ease up, and then he went through the tape and won by a couple of yards. Jerry, as you might imagine, had kind of an entourage of people on the track team and others who'd follow all of his exploits. So immediately this entourage comes running up to him, and they're congratulating him, and one of them says, "Jerry, Jerry, why'd you slow down at the end, man?" And Jerry coolly answered, "I looked over my left shoulder, and I saw that cat wasn't doing shit. Then I looked over my right shoulder and saw that dude wasn't doing shit either. So I just styled on in." Now, Jerry was really fast in the 100 and at least as good in the 220. And because he was so good in the 220, one time I asked the track coach, "Do you think Jerry could break the high school record in the 220 if he quit drinking wine?" And the coach replied, "Well, the wine is one thing, but if he quit smoking cigarettes, he'd really be fast." But the guys in the track team didn't like the coach that much. He was always trying to get them to do more and to train harder. Jerry had great speed and great style, but training hard was not that much of his thing. Let's just put it that way. One day the coach comes up to Jerry, and he wants him to run the 440, because he figures he's so good in the 220, he'd really be good in the 440. There were these two guys who ran the 880, half mile, and they just finished their workout about 15 minutes before that. They were pretty fast in the 440, too. Now the coach thinks he's going to hustle Jerry, so he says to him, "Jerry, I bet you can't beat those two guys in the 440. Jerry says, "You bet me what?" "I'll bet you a milkshake." Jerry says, "All right," and they line up for the race, Jerry and these other two guys, and the coach fires the starter gun. The coach has got his watch out, doing what they call timing splits. They start off running, and when they get to the first split, the first 110 yards, Jerry is ahead by about 15 yards, and his time is under 12 seconds, which means his pace is under 48 seconds for the 440, which is a very good time, especially for a high school runner who hasn't even trained for the 440. So the coach is getting all excited, and they get around to the 220 mark, the halfway mark, and Jerry is ahead by about 30 yards, and his time is under 24 seconds, keeping up the same pace. The coach is getting more excited. Then they get to the 330 mark, three-fourths of the way through, and Jerry's ahead by about 50 yards, and his time is under 36 seconds. He's keeping up the pace, and the coach is really excited now. And then as Jerry comes off the final turn, he's ahead by about 60 yards, and he just slows down and starts loping and wins by about 20 yards. The coach comes running up and exclaims, "Jerry, Jerry, what are you doing? You had perfect splits. You were going to come in under 48 seconds. What'd you slow down for?" Jerry turns and says, "Shit, I knew if I came in with a fast time, under 48 seconds, you were going to make me run the 440. Now give me my milkshake." Most courageous athlete, until. Around 1963 or 1964, after I'd been doing tutoring and helping out in other ways at my old high school, especially with the athletes, some friends of mine got together with some officials of the school, raised some money, and established an award in my name, an award to be given out every year to the most courageous athlete. The first year this was given out, my friends who had been involved in this just told me that we had to go down to Berkeley High because there was something important happening there. It turned out that it was a school assembly where they were introducing and giving out this award. This was the first I had heard of it, so I was very surprised and, of course, moved. The interesting thing, though, is that after I became somewhat notorious in that area as a radical activist, the award was discontinued. For the first year after I got sick, I was still taking very high dosages of the cortisone. I had all these side effects from that, and I had to take other medicines to counteract the side effects. So I felt as if I were a walking pharmacy. I had to take my pills with me everywhere I went. I did my best to make that part of my routine, and I try to get out and do things that I thought were worthwhile, like tutoring. But realistically, I wasn't really able to get back into doing very much for the better part of a year. Even if I could tutor or officiate at track meets, it was very, very limited what I could do. I would get very weak. I'd get very tired very quickly, and I had to be very careful not to get injured or get an infection. And then things would throw me back. It wasn't just this one incident with art, but for a couple of years, when I would go places, say to a bookstore or just walking down the street, I would frequently have this terrible experience where I'd see somebody that I'd gone to school with for years, and I would instantly recognize them, but they would not recognize me. Then they would start looking at me, the way people do sometimes when they wonder, "Do I know that person?" And I would always want to go and hide. Sometimes I would actually try to hide or quickly walk out of the bookstore to get away because I didn't want to go through the excruciating experience where they would finally realize who I was and then would react to how different I looked. Even when they did it in a really good and kind way, I just wanted to avoid it. One time I was with one of my close friends who'd been hanging out with me all this time, and we ran into somebody else that we knew. This person asked my friend, "So, how's Bobby doing?" And I'm standing right there. I told him who I was, of course, but that kind of thing was very painful, and I wanted to avoid those situations. On the other hand, I remember one time when I went to watch a practice of my old high school basketball team. This one guy on the team, my friend Billy, came right up and talked to me very naturally, as if nothing had really changed. That meant a tremendous amount to me, in a way because it was a small thing. Here was this guy who, because of his life conditions, had one foot into the criminal life, even in high school, but who had the sensitivity to know that it was important to me for him to see me as still the same person, and who recognized that the superficialities of how my looks had changed didn't matter. He was able to convey that just by coming up and saying, "Hey, how you doing?" in the way that he did. There were times when the whole thing with the illness would be very discouraging. Taking the cortisone went through cycles. They were trying to get to where they could stabilize me on a low dosage of the medicine and then eventually get me off of it. So they'd knock it down 5 milligrams, and then after a couple of weeks they'd knock it down 5 more milligrams, and so on. All this time I had to go in the doctor's office twice a week and have tests to see how my kidneys were reacting to the lowering of the dose. Near the end of the first year, they'd gotten it down pretty low, and I actually felt a little better because the medicine took a lot out of me. But then the tests started to show that my kidneys were losing function again. So they had to raise the dosage way back up again and then start again slowly trying to reduce it. I would reach those points where I'd start thinking, "Okay, the dosage is getting down, and next week I'll be almost down to nothing, and then after that I won't need any medicine. I'll be back to the way I was." And boom, I'd have a setback, and I had to start over again. The cycle would take the better part of a year, and this happened to me twice, 2 cycles over the better part of 2 years, where we'd get down low in the dosage, and then boom, the symptoms would start showing up again, so they'd have to raise it back up. Coaching. When I got a little stronger, even though I was still taking a lot of medicine for my kidneys and other medicine to counteract the effects of that medicine, I started doing more tutoring and things like officiating at track meets. And one summer I got together, organized, and coached in a summer league the players who were going to be on the varsity next year at Berkeley High. Berkeley High hadn't won the TOC in a long, long time, and I wanted to make it happen that year. So I was tutoring some of these guys along with other people, and then I was coaching them in the summer league. It was a way I could interact with people that I cared about. That was in the second year of my illness, after the first acute phase of a couple of months and the really bad year where I was very weak and it was still kind of touch and go in a very real way, even though I was past the most acute phase. So I was coaching in the summer league, and one of the side effects from this medicine was susceptibility to really bad throat infections. Sometimes I'd lose my voice for as much as a couple of weeks. This happened during the time I was coaching the summer league team, but I was determined to keep on coaching, and my dad helped me out. I managed by sign language or writing things down to indicate to my dad that I wanted him to go down to the playground where they had the summer league and be my assistant coach, or my voice. So we went there together, and I had a clipboard, and whenever anything would happen in the game and I wanted to make a substitution or tell somebody something about what to do in the game, I'd write it down on the paper on the clipboard, and then my dad would be my translator and verbalize it to the players. As it happened, those guys that I coached, and I also tutored some of them, won the league championship that year and qualified for the TOC. They got all the way to the final of the TOC and lost in the final to McClyman's by 1 point in overtime. What made it particularly hard to take is that there was a crucial point right near the end of the game where Berkeley High was ahead of McClyman's by 3 points, and they were putting on a full-court press. This guy from McClyman's threw a pass down court, and my friend Billy, who was a tremendous leaper, went way up in the air and stole the pass. And then he went down and dunked. They would have been up by 5 points with less than 2 minutes to go. But they called him for walking because they said he shuffled his feet in order to get his steps right to dunk the ball. So that was doubly heartbreaking for me, and of course even more so for Billy. I remember going to a basketball game with him years later, and these kids in front of us were talking about, "Billy Carr, you remember the time in the TOC when he took steps and Berkeley High lost?" So he had to live with that for years. But as I said, this loss was heartbreaking for me too. It took me a couple of weeks to get over it. I remember I was at the playground just hanging out back at Live Oak Park, And there was this guy named George who was from Oakland. He started getting in my face about how McClymans had beaten Berkeley High, and I just couldn't take it. So sick as I was and as dangerous as it was for me, I actually tried to challenge him to a fight. But he had a big enough heart that he just sort of grabbed me and turned this hold he had on me into an embrace until I calmed down. Back to Cal and engaged in the world. At the end of that first year of illness, I wanted to go back to Cal. I talked to the doctor and he said, "You know, it could take too much of a toll on you. That kind of a schedule might be just the kind of thing that would cause you to have a whole relapse." But I kept at him and at him and at him, and finally he said, "Okay, I'll write something to the school administration explaining that you can only take a reduced load." I found out later that he separately talked to my parents and told them, "Well, he wants to go, and we might as well let him because this might be his last chance." So I went back to Cal on a reduced schedule, and then I started being able to get into things a little bit more than I had before. I still had to live at home because I had to have a special diet, and I had to take all this medicine, and I had all these side effects from the medicine. My poor mom was basically 24/7 doing this above anything else. But I needed that kind of assistance, or I couldn't have made it. In 1963, when I started to get a little bit better, my father had to go on a trip to Washington and New York, and I had gotten stabilized medically to a point where I could travel and do a few things. So we went to D.C. and we saw the Congress building and went in, and even though I had some criticisms of the government, I still looked upon these government buildings and the people in them with a certain amount of not only respect, but awe. Congress was in session, and I remember walking in and being really struck that there was nobody in there. Here I had this vision from the history books of this place where they had these great debates, and yet this congressman was up there giving a speech, and there were only three or four people in the whole hall, most of them reading newspapers and paying no attention. And one guy was spitting on the floor while he was reading the newspaper. And I'm thinking, is this the way the government is supposed to be run? Then all of a sudden a bell rings and all these congressmen come running in and raise their hands for a vote. Then the vote's over and they all leave. And once again some guy gets up to give a speech that nobody's listening to. This really stuck with me a long time. Of course, I was young at the time, but there were these congressmen I heard of, and when I saw some of them close up, they looked not just old, but decrepit. I asked myself, how can these guys be the people running the country? As part of the same trip, we went to New York City. At that time in New York City, the drinking age was 18, and I was 20. So every night I would leave the hotel that my dad and I were staying in, get on the subway, and go down to the village, walk around, and then go to the Café Wa. I thought it was the greatest scene. They had a Jamaican steel drum band, different comedians, and some other acts. And it was a very vibrant scene there in the Café Wa, and in the village as a whole. Of course, I found out later that my dad would hold his breath every night until I got back at 1 or 2 in the morning after having been in the village all that time. During that period, even though I was still very limited in what I could do, I started to get involved, in the ways I could, in some of the bigger issues that were going on. People may not think of Berkeley in this way, but this was at a time when there was still a lot of open, overt segregation in the schools and in housing, and there was a big struggle about ending that. A lot of these issues were being battled out during that time. There was this ballot initiative to pass a fair housing law in Berkeley, which was narrowly voted down. Now, of course, since then, these things have been changed. But that gives you a sense of what things were like then. I was very much into that battle, even though I could only be involved from a distance, so to speak. For example, there was this talk show host, Les Crane, who was memorialized in a Phil Oakes song, "Love Me, I'm a Liberal." Les Crane was a liberal, and as such, he obviously had his limitations. But he was supporting the right side of this fair housing law. And he had these people on his program, one who was supporting the fair housing ordinance, and then this small, property-owning, narrow-minded conservative type who was opposing the fair housing law. I was listening and getting more and more angry and passionate as this debate was going on, getting infuriated by the arguments of this conservative guy. He kept saying things like, "I'm not a racist. It's not that I want to discriminate on the basis of race. I just don't want the government to tell me what I can do with my own house and who I can and can't sell it to. The government shouldn't be able to tell you what you can do with your own home. So I called up this Les Crane show and got on the air. My parents knew Les Crane and had his private number, so I didn't have to go through the screener. And I said, I want to talk to this guy who's opposing this fair housing thing. I want to ask this guy a question. Are you opposed to the fire regulations that apply to the housing in the city of Berkeley? Well, what do you mean? For example, there are regulations that tell you that you can't have electrical outlets anywhere you want. They have to be separated by so many feet, because there'd be a fire danger otherwise. Are you opposed to those things? Well, no, nobody's opposed to that. You have to have those regulations, he answered. So, I said, you're not opposed to the government regulating what you can do in your house. You just don't want them telling you that you can't refuse to sell your house to black people. This was one outlet I had for my passion that was being stirred by what was happening. I was still very much concerned with what was going on in the larger world beyond me, even though I was severely restricted in being able to be actively involved in anything. The Cuban Missile Crisis. World in the Balance. During the acute period of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, those events and their implications loomed much larger, even in my own mind, than my own situation of being sick. Everybody sensed to one degree or another, certainly anybody who was paying any attention, and most people were, they couldn't help it, that the world could literally end at any time. I still remember feeling very, very deeply, right down into my bones, that the whole world could come to an end. At that time, I was back on a restricted schedule in school, but I followed this whole thing very intensely. Of course, they always give you only the U.S. imperialist side of the picture, and that's what people get drummed into them. I remember this dramatic incident that they still like to replay from time to time, when Adlai Stevenson, who was the U.S. representative to the United Nations, gave this speech where he showed these photos of the Soviet missiles that had been brought into Cuba. And then he turned to the Soviet ambassador and said, "Are those or are those not Soviet missiles in Cuba? I can wait here till hell freezes over, Mr. Ambassador." The Soviet ambassador wouldn't answer, and Stevenson just kept saying, "Are they or aren't they, Mr. Ambassador?" On and on like that, putting him on the spot. But they never show how a year before that, at the beginning of the Kennedy administration, Adlai Stevenson got up and vehemently denied in the United Nations that the U.S. had anything to do with the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, which of course was a blatant lie. So they like to show the one thing on TV as a highlight from history, but not the other thing where Stevenson was overtly lying in front of the whole world. At the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy put a naval blockade around Cuba and said that if any Soviet ship tried to break that blockade, that would be an act of war, and the U.S. would respond. Kennedy tried to justify this, and I remember this very clearly, by claiming that the Soviet Union had violated the U.N. Charter by putting missiles in Cuba. Now, even though I had a lot of suspicions about the government already at that time, and even though I was very angry about a lot of injustices in American society, and especially the oppression of black people, I still wanted to believe in my government. I still wanted to believe that the government could at least be brought around to doing the right thing. And I didn't want to believe that on something where literally the fate of the world was involved, they would just openly lie to everybody. But I felt strongly, with the fate of the world up for grabs and hanging by a thread, that I have to know the truth here. So I went to the university library and I dug out the UN Charter, remembering that Kennedy said it was a violation of the UN Charter for the Soviet Union to have missiles in Cuba. I read the whole charter through, and I naively expected I would find a statement in the charter that would say, "It is a violation of this charter for the Soviet Union to have missiles in Cuba." Of course, I didn't find anything of the kind. So then I started looking into it further. Well, does it say it's a violation for one country to put missiles into another country? Of course, there wasn't anything like that in the charter either. And as I later found out, the U.S. had missiles all over the place, including in Turkey. And even though the ones in Turkey were older generation missiles, they were still missiles that could set off nuclear devices. These missiles in Turkey were closer to the Soviet border than Cuba was to the U.S. border. But they weren't talking about that either in the U.S. media. I kept looking for anything in this U.N. charter that would justify what Kennedy was saying about how this was a violation of the charter. I read that charter over and over, and I couldn't find anything. Kennedy was just lying. He was really saying, we can do whatever we want, and nobody can do anything we don't want them to do. That was the logic he was using then, and that's the logic that right up to Bush they use now. Some of my favorite lines from Bob Dylan are in the song where he talks about trying to get in a nuclear fallout shelter, and the owner says, get out of here, I'll tear you limb from limb. Then the next lines are, I said, you know, they refused Jesus too. He said, you're not him. The way of thinking or not thinking that Dylan captured there. The inability or unwillingness to engage in abstract thought and to abstract from one situation to another. The refusal to be consistent in applying a principle. What applies to you doesn't apply to me. I can do what I want, and you can't do it if I don't want you to. That same sort of you're not him or you're not me logic was being applied by Kennedy. And this was a big shock to me. I knew some things about injustices in American society, but lying on this level, lying before the world with the fate of the world literally at stake, was more than I expected. It may have been unusual to actually go and pore through the UN Charter, but there was so much at stake that I felt like I have to know the truth, and just because it's the leader of my country, I can't accept what he says when something this big is at stake. Of course, this didn't immediately cause me to become a communist. I was still against communism, as much as I understood it, which was very little. But it shook me up a lot and kept circulating in my mind as other events, like Vietnam a little later, unfolded. The Cuban Missile Crisis and things like the fair housing struggle contributed to my feeling that there were important things in the world and I should do something about those things. I should do something important with my life when I got my life back. I still had the passion that I had for sports and things like that, but that was something you do for entertainment and fun. I mean, your life could be about that, and I always thought that if I hadn't ended up being a communist, maybe I would have been a high school basketball coach. But I was feeling that my life should be about something more than sports, as much as I still had a real passion about that. I felt that there were so many big things going on in the world. I wanted to do something with my life that would mean something, or to use the phrase of the time, be relevant, and not just be a personal passion for me. A scientific approach. Being sick didn't turn me back to God. I no longer believed that God existed, and being sick didn't make me feel any more like I should believe that God existed. I didn't think God had anything to do with this. I didn't yet have a communist, dialectical materialist approach to things, but I did have a sort of basic scientific approach. I would always ask my doctor over and over again why this happened, and he'd say simply, I don't know. But the fact that he didn't know, the fact that there are things we don't know at any given time, is not a reason to start inventing imaginary causes and forces to explain things. That just gets in the way of actually learning more about the reality of things. I really love this doctor, Dr. Meyer. He never charged us a single thing for the intensive care and then the years of ongoing medical treatment because he took a liking to our family and to me. And it wasn't just us. He died recently, and when I read his obituary, I learned even more what a great guy he was and how this had been a part of his whole approach to medicine, to give people the medical care they needed, even if they couldn't pay for it. He'd finally quit practicing medicine late in his life because these HMOs would not let him really give people the kind of medical care that they needed. All during the time I was sick, he let me come into his office at any time and have the tests done that I needed. And whenever I'd go into his office, I would see people who could not afford the medical care he was giving them. He was giving it to them free, or letting them pay what they could, and charging other people who could afford it in order to keep his practice going. So whenever I'd ask him why did this happen or what was the cause of this, he'd answer, and I still remember the way he'd say this to me, in his inimitable style and voice, I don't know. He never was able to say what caused this reaction in my body, but I never thought it was punishment from God or that God had anything to do with it. This was a medical condition, It came on because of natural causes, real-world things, even if the precise causes couldn't be known. Just because the doctor was honest enough to simply say, "I don't know," and couldn't tell me exactly why this happened, didn't mean that I started looking to supposed supernatural causes for this. As I said, I felt that casting off belief in all that stuff was an emancipation for me, and I felt absolutely no pull toward wanting to go back to believing in what I frankly regarded as superstition. There are many things we obviously still don't understand, but there are many things that people thousands of years ago didn't understand that we do understand now. They made up myths and stories to explain things they couldn't explain otherwise, and then the ruling classes down through the ages have found it convenient to keep people believing in these kinds of things. But I had gotten free of that, and there was no attraction to me to go back into believing in that stuff. This was a real-world thing that had happened to me, and there was a real-world way that I was going to get over it, by putting up with all this medicine and struggling to regain my health. That was my part of the struggle. I put up with the medicine and all the side effects and everything else, and even when the medicine itself knocked me down, I'd get up and keep going, because that's the way I felt this was going to be dealt with. Not by praying or turning back to some religious views that I'd come to understand didn't really represent the truth about the way the world is and the way things are. Turning the corner. After a year of going to Cal on a limited schedule, by 1963 I was feeling better and able to take a more regular load. This was a time when important changes were starting to take place around Vietnam. In fact, one day I was walking on the campus and all these people started running down toward the gym. I didn't know what this was about, but even though I couldn't really run at the time, I was walking as fast as I could to try to keep up, and I asked somebody, "What's going on?" They said that Madame Nu had been invited by the university to speak in the gym. Madame Nu was the wife of the brother of the president, so-called, of South Vietnam, the U.S. puppet Diem, and her husband was the head of the secret police. She was there speaking on behalf of the U.S. puppet government and the U.S. intervention in Vietnam. And people were protesting, even then. People were running to try to get into the auditorium to protest Madame Nu's appearance at the university. This was just before Kennedy and the CIA decided that Monsieur Nu and Diem had become a liability and had them assassinated, and just before Kennedy himself was assassinated. But anyway, there were things like that going on that seemed to come out of the blue. At the same time, my health was slowly recovering, though it wasn't in a straight line. It was kind of one step backward and a couple of steps forward, and then two steps backward sometimes. The thing that kind of turned the corner for me, ironically, actually started when I was lying in bed one morning. I think it was in the summer of 63, and I started getting this really severe stomach pain, like I'd never experienced before, as if someone took a 2x4 and hit you in the stomach as hard as they possibly could when you were not expecting it. This pain just kept getting worse and worse, and I was literally doubling over. So finally I woke up my parents. At first they didn't realize how serious it was, but as soon as they did, they called the doctor, and the doctor said, "He's got a perforated ulcer," which means it had broken open and was bleeding into the stomach. The cortisone I was taking, among other things, can give you an ulcer. So I had to be rushed to the hospital, and they put a tube, but it felt like a hose, through my nose down into my stomach to drain the stomach. They severely restricted my diet. They decided that I was too vulnerable and fragile to undergo surgery. But because of the ulcer, they stopped the cortisone treatments, and there was a question of what was going to happen as a result of that. Surprisingly to both me and the doctors, my body didn't respond too badly to not having the cortisone. I didn't get well, but I didn't get really, really sick either. So then my doctor came to me and said, "Look, I've been doing some reading on this, and there's this treatment that they first used in Italy with these corticosteroids, where instead of giving you a fairly high dose every day, they give you a fairly high dose for part of the week and then discontinue it for the rest of the week. The theory was that it was like giving a jolt to the body, almost like a kickstart to get the body to recover." He told me, "We want to try this on you, since you seem to have tolerated fairly well these couple of weeks when you weren't taking any cortisone." So they started with this treatment, and as it turned out, this was like turning a corner for me. Just before this, I'd gone through my second long cycle of going down, down, down in the dosage of the medicine, and then just when I thought maybe I was going to be through with this and get off the medicine, I went in on a Friday when the doctor was out of town, and the nurses did the tests and discovered that some of the symptoms, in particular the protein in the urine, had begun to reappear. So I got really down. But when I went back and saw the doctor on Monday, he said, "You idiot, that's just a little setback. We'll deal with it." That was always his attitude, and it helped get my spirits up, even though I still had to up the dosage of the medicine again. But then, not long after that, I had this ulcer perforate, and after seeing that I did pretty well without any cortisone for a few weeks, they decided to try this new approach. Generally, when you have to take all these steroids, it has a lot of different effects on you, and I'd feel really weakened and tired a lot of the time. But now it was a completely different experience, and eventually it evolved to where I would take the steroids on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, pretty high doses, and then nothing Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. I was carrying pretty much a regular load at the university at that point and trying to do other things, but then I had to adjust my week to the rhythm of this treatment. I started on Thursday taking the steroids, and by Thursday night I was flying. Cortisone is actually an extract from the adrenal gland, so it's like a jolt of adrenaline, and by the time it kicked in on Thursday night, man, I was going. And Friday and Saturday I was going. Then on Sunday I would stop the medicine, and by Sunday afternoon it was almost like withdrawal symptoms. My nose would start running, my stomach would get sick, I'd feel just completely sapped of energy, and I couldn't hardly do anything. On Monday, I felt really draggy. Then by Tuesday, Wednesday, I'd sort of feel leveled off and okay. And by Thursday night, I was back on the steroids and flying again. This went on for the better part of a year. But it turned out that either my body was just ready to respond and or this different treatment actually did work better. But for whatever reason, I started noticing real improvement in how I felt. And my body was responding well. So that by the summer of 1964, more or less a year later, they finally took me off the medicine altogether. My doctor told me, "Well, it looks like you might make it now. We're going to have to keep monitoring you very carefully for a while." And for years they did. "But it looks like you might make it. You might be through this." And I never had to go back to the cortisone after 3 years of taking it. In 1964, when I was just starting to feel better and on my way to recovery, though not fully recovered yet from all the sickness, I turned 21, so I could go to bars and things like that. I wasn't a big drinker at that time, but I liked to go to clubs and see different acts. One time, the Coasters were performing at a club in North Oakland, and I really wanted to go see them. I couldn't find anybody to go with me that time, so I just went by myself. Around that time, the Coasters had out this song called "Tain't Nothin' to Me," sort of a novelty song, which was characteristic of the Coasters. A whole funny song that I really liked. And I liked a lot of the other Coasters' classics, so I really wanted to go see them. So I went, but the show didn't start until pretty late, and when you sit in a bar, you have to drink. So I had a couple of drinks. Then the Coasters came on, and they did the first set. They did "Tain't Nothin' to Me" and some other songs. But then they said, "Okay, we're going to take a break now. We'll do a second set in a little while." I'm thinking, "Oh man, I really want to hear more, so I'm going to stick around for the second set." But then I had to drink more. I'm sitting at the bar, I order another drink, and I start drinking the drink, and then I set it down. And the next thing I know, somebody's tapping me kind of forcefully on the shoulder. I look up, realizing that I've fallen asleep, and I'm staring into the face of the bartender. And he says, "You can't fall asleep in here, you got to stay awake, or you got to leave." You know, I wonder what the other people in the bar thought, what the bartender thought. But here I was, the only white guy in this bar, a little bit embarrassed that I'd fallen asleep and had to be awakened by the bartender. Some people later told me that this sounded like a scary experience, but I just thought the whole thing was great.